Week one of our journey in becoming a more emotionally healthy church. I've entitled the message, The Whole Person. In the beginning, when God created human beings, it became evident to humans themselves that there seemed to be something different about being human, in contrast to being feline, canine, porcine, equine, or avian, reptilian or amphibian. We utter life's first cries. We gasp for the life-giving presence of the breath of God. We are unique in the animal kingdom, as our biblical and theological perspective on being human is that we are made in the image of God. But what does that mean? To be created in God's image. Throughout church history, there has been universal agreement that the image of God is a significant theological concept. But debate has abounded regarding what the image fundamentally refers to. Some have argued in favour of a structural view that believes the human ontological qualities, that is, the very nature of being, such as rationality, cognitive capacity, that this is what constitutes the image of God. These qualities distinguish humankind from the rest of creation, and early church leaders such as Irenaeus and Augustine, as well as John Calvin, held variants of this particular view. Another position is the relational view that stresses the importance of human relationships. Emil Brunner and Karl Barth advocated this approach, where being made in God's image fundamentally entails living in relationship with God and with others. A third view is the functional or vice regency position that holds humankind's authority to rule on behalf of God, that this defines the image. Unlike the rest of creation, it is humans that function as God's chief representative in the world. And this view stresses the command to exercise dominion over all the other creatures. Now, I'm hesitant to embrace the third definition because it has been misinterpreted and distorted to justify humankind's destruction of creation. However, understanding the image of God as being both who humankind is and what humankind does, I think is most helpful. That is to say that the very nature of being human, with all of our capacities to think, feel, and discover, along with our functionality in relating to God and to one another, these are inseparably tied because the human person, as a created whole, is the image of God. For at least 1400 years, it was universally accepted that the earth was the centre of the universe. Ptolemy, the great ancient Greek astronomer, had supposedly proven this to be true. Subsequently, everyone accepted as fact that the sun and universe revolved around the earth. Then Copernicus, a Polish scientist in the 1500s, challenged that assumption, followed later by Galileo. They saw the problems and inconsistencies with this long-standing view of the world and presented a radically new paradigm. In their analysis, the Earth was simply one of the many planets orbiting around the sun in a vast universe. Galileo went even further, saying that even the sun is a small object in an infinite number of galaxies. This new paradigm shook the foundations of how society and the church viewed themselves. It was deeply unsettling to accept that people were only a small speck in a vast galaxy. For such a sacrilegious way of looking at the universe and its implications for the people's faith, Galileo was summoned to Rome and found to be vehemently suspected of heresy and eventually condemned to house arrest for life. He was also forbidden to publish his works. The change from Ptolemy's worldview to that of Copernicus came as a result of the evidence that the old way of looking at things was no longer adequate. A new paradigm was needed, a new way of looking at and understanding the universe. The term Copernican revolution was coined to describe the fundamental and permanent shift in human thought that occurred as a result of this new paradigm. The thesis of the books, The Emotionally Healthy Church and Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, may be somewhat of a Copernican revolution for us as church. Schizzaro writes that it is not possible for a Christian to be spiritually mature while remaining emotionally immature. In other words, Peter Schizzaro asserts that emotional health and spiritual health are in fact inseparable. For some of us, this will be a revelation, and for others of us, it will affirm what we already know and practice. Sadly, there's been a long history of Christians who live as if spiritual maturity and emotional maturity have little or nothing to do with each other. There appears to be a total lack of congruence in the character of such people, but we have seemingly learned to accept this. Schizzaro offers these examples of contrast. You can be a dynamic, gifted speaker for God in public and be an unloving spouse and parent at home. You can function as a minister or as an elder of the church and be unteachable, insecure and defensive. You can memorize entire books of the New Testament and still be unaware of your depression and anger, even displacing it on other people. You can fast and pray a half day a week for years as a spiritual discipline and constantly be critical of others, justifying it as discernment. You can lead hundreds of people in a Christian ministry while being driven by a deep personal need to compensate for a nagging sense of failure. You can pray for deliverance from the demonic realm when in reality you are simply avoiding conflict, repeating an unhealthy pattern of behaviour traced back to the home in which you grew up. You can be outwardly cooperative at church, but unconsciously try to undercut the authority of others by coming habitually late, constantly forgetting meetings, withdrawing and becoming apathetic, or ignoring the real issue behind why you are hurt and angry. You can see the discord between those descriptions of that public expression and the private. Where did we get the idea that spiritual maturity can be achieved apart from an integration of the emotional aspects of who we are? Where did the subtle bias come from that values the spiritual over the physical, emotional, social, and intellectual aspects of who we are as human beings? The answer is somewhat complex, but can be summarized simply as the influence of a Greek philosopher named Plato. He lived several centuries before Christ. Plato influenced the thinking of many scholars throughout church history, including St. Augustine of Hippo, and his influence continues in the church to this day. The message is that spiritual things are good, but things of the body, such as the physical and emotional, are bad or of less value. Therefore, the implied message that has become imbued into church life and filtered into our thinking is that to be emotional is somehow sinful, or at least less than spiritual. For example, we may inwardly frown upon anyone who becomes angry. This perspective comes from Platonism and Gnosticism rather than from the scriptures. We are more than spiritual beings. As creatures made in the image of God, we are physical. We are emotional. We are intellectual. We are social and we are spiritual beings. That is the whole of who we are. Denying any aspect of what it means to be fully human, a person made in the image of God carries with it catastrophic long-term consequences in our relationship with God, in our relationship with each other, and in our relationship with ourselves. Unhealthy developments are inevitable when we fail to understand ourselves as whole people, made in the image of Creator God. For some reason, many of us exalt the spiritual over the other essential aspects that make us human. For example, Scazzaro writes about these unhealthy distortions. Some of these things you might have heard said by others. Perhaps some of them seem a little bit out there. But in denying the physical, the quote is, "Who has time to exercise or to eat right or to get enough rest? Our body will perish anyway." With regard to the social, "Oh, don't worry about those friendships. Kingdom work is what really counts. You'll have time to be friends in heaven." The intellectual, "Beware of developing your mind or studying too much. You'll end up with no heart for God." The emotional, "It seems that when you get in touch with your feelings, you become more confused and not closer to God. Be wary of psychologizing the gospel." A little earlier, we heard this part of Ephesians chapter 4 read to us, commencing at verse 21. "When you heard about Christ and were taught in him in accordance with the truth, that is Jesus, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness." At the Council of Chalcedon in AD 451, the gathering of church leaders declared that Jesus was fully God and fully human. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The two natures of Christ, clear and recognizable, but intimately entwined together in the person of Jesus. It is in and through Jesus Christ that we find salvation, redemption, and transformation from the old self to the new self. We are transformed from the inside out by the renewing of our minds. Today, a part of that renewing comes with a fresh understanding of the importance of congruence. Congruence of our interior world, the world of our thoughts and our emotions, with our exterior world, our relationship with God and with each other. When we lack congruence or integrity between our inner and our outer worlds, we become those people that Jesus often spoke of. The term that Jesus repeatedly used towards the religious leaders who expressed a gap, a differential between their interior and exterior worlds. He was to name them as hypocrites. And the word hypocrisy literally means play acting. What is particularly frightening is that this play acting is often taught and expected in Christian churches. We are encouraged not to be so honest about our feelings with others. The result is that many people are unaware of the dichotomy between their interior and exterior worlds. While our exterior or external world includes not only our relationships with others, but the things going on in the world around us, our interior or internal world is that which is going on inside of us. This is what we feel, what we value, what we honour. This is what we love, what we hate, what we fear, and what we believe in. To truly love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength requires that we know not only God, but also the interior, the nature of our heart, soul and mind. Understanding that world of feelings, thoughts, desires and hopes with all its richness and complexity. It's hard work. And it also takes time. Lots of time. When we make that discovery of the congruence between our inner and outer lives and the deep points of connection between our spiritual maturity and our emotional maturity, and when we are honest with ourselves about who we really are, it can be as transforming as a Copernican revolution, not only in our own lives, but in the life of our congregation here at Glebe Road. The journey has begun. In the name of Christ.